gives us some insight into how those who believe in the Bible and in the teachings of Christ should view the positive aspects of capitalism. You will notice that I said the positive aspects of capitalism, which suggest there are negative aspects as well. We have discussed greed already, which really encompasses most of the other negative aspects of capitalism, such as lack of regard for the environment. Many of the industrialists who helped propel our country to the forefront of the global economy were much more interested in growing their businesses than they were in protecting the environment. The result? The dangerous pollution and the compromised habitat of many animals. Protecting the environment is neither a democratic nor a republican position, but rather it should be a logical position for capitalist and socialist, because everyone should be looking out for the interest of future generations and trying to protect their own health as well. Having a clean and healthy environment is beneficial to everyone, no matter what their political persuasion. If our government were able to identify what needs to be done in our country to protect our environment, and our representatives, who are supposed to be looking out for their constituents, agreed on our policies and followed through on them, it would benefit us all. To whom much is given. I once met legendary entrepreneur A.G. Gaston, a multimillionaire who had funded a significant portion of the civil rights movement in the South. He was 95 years old at the time, and during our conversation together at Tuskegee University in Alabama, I asked him the following question. Mr. Gaston, how did you, as a black man, become a multimillionaire in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 1930s to 1950s? For as most of you will know, Birmingham, Alabama was a bastion of racism during that time. It's very simple, he said. I just opened my eyes, looked around, and asked myself, what do people need? I then went about fulfilling those needs. In the process, he created multiple businesses, including an insurance company and a bank. And in doing so, he became a very wealthy individual. But it was what he did with that wealth that was extraordinary, supporting the civil rights struggles in Birmingham and throughout the South. This is a splendid example of a capitalist who was extraordinarily compassionate and did a great deal to improve society for all of us. Many like-minded capitalists make enormous contributions to the well-being of our society. Sometimes, contributions are made on a smaller scale than that of Gaston, but all of these contributions, large or small, add up. Hundreds of thousands of bright, hard-working entrepreneurs start their own businesses to ensure their own financial security and the security of their families. In the process, they create jobs for other people. In fact, small businesses and the private sector create 80% of the private sector jobs in this country. In 2010, before the national elections, the question of whether or not to raise taxes on the rich, defined by the government as families with a household income of $250,000 a year or more, was widely debated. Some felt that anyone making that much money could certainly afford to pay more taxes, and in fact, should do so since the vast majority of the population did not enjoy such affluence. Wealth should be redistributed fairly, they argued. However, those who were targeted for this tax increase included many small business owners, and those with a better understanding of how capitalism works felt just as strongly that it would be a huge mistake to impose higher taxes on the very people who create the majority of private sector jobs. If you continually punish those who are economically successful through higher and higher taxes, at some point you extinguish the desire to work hard, since they will be working harder for a smaller return and their profits will increasingly go to the government. Many of the rich people in this country have been extremely generous with their money, and they are to be commended for this generosity. Some haven't, but the government shouldn't take from either of them against their will. The Constitution is quite clear that the government has the right to tax in order to support its programs, but there is nothing in the Constitution to support redistribution of wealth. Some proponents of big government get around this by creating many programs and then argue that these have to be supported by taxes. In this way, they redistribute wealth according to their agenda. As a society, we need to be mature enough to recognize that the wealthy in this nation provide many opportunities for those who are not rich by creating jobs and paying taxes. The fact is, the top 50% of wage earners in the United States pay 97% of the taxes. The top 2% earn 19% of all wages, but pay 52% of all taxes. Since almost 50% of the population pays no federal income tax at all, you can see that the more affluent constituents of society are already supporting the less fortunate to a large extent. I am a huge proponent of humanitarian efforts, and I strongly believe that to whom much is given, of him shall much be required. Luke 12:48. This is the reason that the humanitarian component of the Carson Scholars Fund is so important. In order to be nominated for one of the scholarships, a student must not only have a near-perfect grade point average, but he or she must also demonstrate humanitarian qualities. A student cannot win if they are simply smart and successful, but don't care about other people, for we want to encourage the same values of productivity and generosity that characterize many of the men and women who helped this nation become the world power that it is today. Capitalism has worked well, and it could work again. Capitalism has worked very well for the United States of America, but like every economic system, it does have its shortcomings. There is no perfect system, quite simply because there are no perfect people. Even with capitalism, some government regulation is necessary. As James Madison said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. As I mentioned earlier in this chapter, it is true that some capitalists care only about making money and disregard the well-being of their fellow human beings and the environment. A responsible government certainly should exercise oversight in every economic model, including the capitalist model. Appropriate regulations should protect the environment and the rights of all its citizens. For example, a chemical factory should not be allowed to dump toxic waste in an area where people or significant animal populations can be harmed. By the same token, some degree of government regulation is necessary for our large financial institutions to prevent the kinds of tragedies that occurred during and immediately after the great stock market crash of 1929 and again in 2008. The real shame is that we did recognize the importance of financial regulation after the great crash of 1929 and appropriately developed safeguards in the 1930s. Unfortunately, we decided to start deregulating financial institutions during the 1990s, paving the way for the economic meltdown in 2008. When it comes to defending the economic viability of our nation, it is naive to count on the honesty and integrity of people responsible for our markets when they stand to gain so much by manipulating the system to their advantage. If we become paranoid and overregulate the financial markets, however, we will not see peak performance from them. That hurts everybody's retirement plans with its domino effect. This is one of the reasons that a balance of viewpoints in our legislative bodies is not only healthy, but also necessary. Our founding fathers understood human nature, including the desire for power and a tendency toward greed. Therefore, our broad regulatory principles should be aimed at stifling excessive power and greed. We need many wise counselors focusing on the kinds of regulations that accomplish these goals without suppressing productivity and growth. With all of the intellect that exists in our nation, it should be easy for us to come up with bipartisan, business-friendly policies to encourage businesses and manufacturers to bring their factories and offices back to our land. Logical people from both parties should sit down with business leaders who have moved much of their business offshore and ask them why they did. Then, work with them to find solutions that will bring them back. We all want a prosperous and thriving nation, and if we appropriately analyze the problems that preclude prosperity, we can certainly find the solutions. Doing so would lead to the creation of jobs, which is essential to the maintenance of the middle class, the backbone of America. A friend of mine who lives in Connecticut is a self-made multimillionaire who owns many businesses and has a very keen business mind. In order to instantly create many more jobs in the United States, he has proposed that we place a stiff tariff on products that are manufactured in other countries and are shipped here fully assembled, while reducing tariffs on products that will require assembly once they reach our shores. In order to assemble the latter group of products, many workers would have to be hired. Given the severe trade imbalance that we are already experiencing, such a policy would have a dramatic impact on the American job market. This is just one example of how government could enhance job creation, thus expanding the tax base rather than killing jobs with ever-increasing taxes. Today we live in the information age, where knowledge is power. Yet, as I discussed earlier, almost one-third of all our students fail or drop out of high school before graduation. In many inner-city schools, the dropout rate is considerably higher than that. It is time for corporate America and the rest of society to band together to stop the hemorrhaging and give these young people the incentive and tools to complete their education and become a part of a can-do society versus a what-can-you-do-for-me society. For a well-functioning capitalistic society cannot sustain itself without a steady supply of enthusiastic and hard-working individuals who are excited about achieving the American dream. Chapter 6. Socialism. Whose pot of soup is it? Since my mother had only a third-grade education and was functionally illiterate, there weren't many lucrative job opportunities available to her. To compensate, she worked two and sometimes even three jobs, cleaning the houses of wealthy families and caring for their children. She frequently left the house at 5 in the morning and did not return until midnight, which meant that Curtis and I would sometimes not see her for several days at a time. When she was at home, you could see the fatigue in her eyes, but the little time and energy she did have, she always spent on Curtis and me. It was clear that whether she was working or spending time with us, she wanted us to have a better life than the one we had. When other families went on outings, for example, we couldn't. There simply wasn't enough money. Every once in a while, however, Mother would save up enough for us to go to the fair, but only enough for us to get in the gate. We had to enjoy the rides by watching others. We couldn't try our hand at any of the games, no matter how much we practiced pitching coins or playing basketball at home. Most adults can recall wonderful childhood taste, from nibbling on cotton candy, hot dogs, French fries, ice cream, and rainbow-colored snow cones. But Curtis and I had to be content to only smell, never taste. Being unable to give us many of the little joys of childhood weighed heavily on my mother. When we'd arrive at the checkout counter in a grocery store and have to run the inevitable gauntlet of assorted candies, we'd ask her if we could have something this time. But the answer was always no. The look in her eyes was so devastating that after a while, we wouldn't even ask. There was no money for a babysitter either, so Curtis and I were pretty much left on our own. But Mother was always creative in coming up with ways for us to make ends meet. In the summertime, for example, when farmers' crops were ready for harvest, she would drive us out to the country on the weekend, stop at a farmhouse, and offer to pick 4 bushels of a crop if we could keep one. Farmers usually complied, and we'd bring home fresh vegetables or fruit, such as strawberries, peaches, tomatoes, and green beans. Although we may have complained about the work, it was fun picking produce together as a family. And once we returned home, she would can many of the items to sustain us during the winter months. Most of Mother's friends and relatives also struggling with economic hardship were quite happy to lean on public assistance. As a child, I overheard many conversations in which they detailed schemes, some of which were quite elaborate, for obtaining more government aid. Take a course in a community college, I heard them say, to make it appear that you were trying to escape welfare. That will get you extra money for child care. Your social worker, who will be so happy and proud of you, can be easily manipulated. By the time they grow weary of their work and move on, another one will have been assigned to your case. I often wonder what they could have accomplished if they had spent that intellectual energy developing a new business. My mother steadfastly resisted her friend's lifestyle because even though she only had a third-grade education, she had noticed that almost no one who became a welfare mom ever came off of welfare, and she was repulsed by the thought of perpetually depending on others. The attitude of my mother's friends and relatives was very similar to that of the students in a course I took in school, in which only 2 grades were given, satisfactory and unsatisfactory. Many of the students in that particular class who usually strove to excel relaxed and set aside any notion of spending long hours studying to get an A on an exam, let alone working for extra credit. After all, they knew they would receive, at best, a grade of satisfactory, no matter how hard they worked. On the one hand, it comforted many students to know that they would pass the course without ever having to extend themselves much. But on the other hand, it discouraged many students from working hard to achieve excellence. Some might question the wisdom of my mother's drive towards self-sufficiency and her no-nonsense parenting of us boys, but I believe the proof is in the pudding. One son became an aviation engineer, and the other became a neurosurgeon, two of the most prestigious professions. Many children of the wealthy clients for whom she worked managed to only just get by in life, or worse. Some ended up dead, in the penal system, or on welfare. My journey from inner-city poverty to board-certified neurosurgeon was arduous and expensive, as it is for anyone who decides to become a doctor. Today, even those from middle-class families graduate from medical school with student debt equivalent to the mortgage on a house. They are not able to pay off those debts for several more years because they also have to complete an internship, and in many cases, several years of residency with very modest wages. Doctors today are frequently well into their 30s by the time they are able to even begin addressing their debts. In many other countries, medical education is completely subsidized by the government because they realize that the physicians will contribute substantially to the well-being of their society. Since the graduating doctors in those countries are not saddled with the burden of great financial debt, they are free to choose the area of medicine that appeals most to them without focusing on the salary of any given specialty. The question then is, are there aspects of socialism that are worth keeping or incorporating into the fabric of our society? Or does capitalism have the upper hand when it comes to solutions? Risks and rewards. In the United States, physicians in high-paying specialties are increasing much faster than primary care physicians, largely because graduating doctors choose their specialties based on the amount of debt they have incurred rather than based on their interest and talents. This is a problem that we can solve quickly and relatively inexpensively by eliminating or greatly reducing medical school tuition. By embracing a positive aspect of socialism, medical education would be subsidized for the good of the entire nation. Admitting there are beneficial aspects of socialism, however, does not obligate us to completely reorient our nation's economic system. The resulting increase in the number of primary care physicians would address many of the problems that patients in this country currently face regarding access to doctors. However, in the same way that capitalists and socialists differ over who should pay for and receive benefits, tension exists in the medical community over the disparity in salaries among the specialties. Those in the lower-paying specialties frequently resent what they consider excessive salaries paid to specialists such as cardiothoracic surgeons and neurosurgeons. In multi-specialty practices or academic medical centers, those lucrative specialty departments usually subsidize the other departments, making things more equitable. I bring this up because this paradigm reflects our society at large and is somewhat analogous to the argument between capitalism and socialism. Capitalists would say that those who work the longest and hardest and are exposed to the most risk should receive the greatest financial rewards, while socialists would say that everyone has essentially equal training in the same general profession, thus it is unfair for one to receive more compensation than another. It is easy to see validity in both points of view upon a superficial analysis. However, a deeper look at the differences between the specialties is revealing. Certain specialties, such as neurosurgery and obstetrics, face enormous medical legal costs because we continue to leave tort reform, legal reform aimed at reining in out-of-control lawsuits within the healthcare sector, unaddressed. In some of our major cities, such as Philadelphia and Chicago, the average malpractice premium for a neurosurgeon exceeds $300,000 annually. It is also commonly accepted that three of the highest stress occupations are 911 operator, air traffic controller, and neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeons generally die several years earlier than the population at large. I recently went back and calculated the average age of death of 10 neurosurgeons that I knew personally, and was shocked to discover the number to be in the lower 60s. I'm hopeful that the age is now on the rise since more attention is being placed on the number of hours worked and alleviation of stress, but we still have a long way to go. Many people in surgical specialties also have to retire earlier because physical skills decline more quickly than mental skills. Although many wish to deny it, vision and dexterity at age 70 is unlikely to be comparable to the same at age 30. So when one takes into account years of training, amount of stress, life expectancy, and earlier retirement, it should be easy to see that few people would consider certain specialties if there were no differential remuneration. This is not to say that these individuals are only interested in money, but in a capitalistic society, risk-taking and sacrifice are frequently rewarded financially. Which way are immigrants flowing? Not long ago, Candy and I had an opportunity to visit Cuba with a group of young American business leaders. There, the government essentially owns and controls everything, including where people live, what they do for a living, and how much they earn. Certain people who are smiled on by the government are allowed to rent elegant accommodations and enjoy a privileged lifestyle, while the vast majority of the population must be satisfied with meager resources. However, their basic health care needs are taken care of, and they are unlikely to be homeless or starving. A university professor in Cuba makes little more than an unskilled laborer, and in some cases, less. In addition, many of our waiters and waitresses had advanced education degrees, but found that they could earn more money waiting tables. The many street vendors and performers in the main city squares created a festive facade, but having spoken to many Cuban refugees, I could only sympathize with the masses of people and hope that someday they can experience true freedom. Although some people, such as the documentary filmmaker Michael Moore, extol the virtues of Cuban society, the tide of illegal immigration is from Cuba to America, not vice versa. More people seem to prefer freedom with the opportunity to create security than security without freedom. If people could freely choose which type of society they preferred to live in, life would be very fair. Unfortunately, although Americans are free to leave this country anytime they want to go live somewhere else, such privileges are not afforded to the average Cuban or those in many other countries where the government controls their lives. In socialism, some are still more equal than others. To be fair, some people love socialism's ideas, which they see as bringing about a utopian existence. They feel there is less conflict and competition when everyone is treated the same. But does the socialist ideal of equality hold? One summer, I worked at a Chrysler plant in Detroit as a pre-assembly line worker, monotonously welding hour after hour. It was quite boring work, and I received a decent salary whether I worked hard or decreased my production. What I really wanted to do was be a driver who moved the finished product from the end of the assembly line to a large parking lot. Those jobs went to a privileged few with connections in the company. However, I worked so hard at my job that eventually management noticed and gave me my dream job as a driver. In socialistic systems, as in capitalist ones, intelligence and diligence are often eventually noticed, and individuals are moved into privileged positions. In other words, you could say that although everyone is equal in socialism, some are more equal than others. So differential treatment is a part of socialism just as it is in capitalism. But in the latter system, self-dependency and self-reliance play the larger role in one's advancement, whereas in the former system, currying favor with the powers that be and hoping to be noticed plays the larger role in advancement. Does socialism's safety net hold or eventually tear under the weight? One of the most appealing aspects of socialism is the safety net it provides for its citizens. Because all resources are supposedly distributed in an equitable fashion, there should be enough money, food, and services to provide everyone with a reasonable lifestyle. Theoretically, socialism eliminates the disparity between some living with great wealth while others live in poverty. This system requires that the government have intimate knowledge of everyone's personal property and resources in order to be able to redistribute wealth. Although most Americans have great compassion for those less fortunate than themselves, very few would agree to involuntarily sharing all they had earned by their hard work with people they didn't even know. When I was growing up, a homeless man came to our church one Sabbath, and he kept talking about how hungry he was. My mother had made an enormous pot of chili, my favorite food, so she invited the man home for dinner. I have never seen anyone eat so many bowls of chili, but he was eventually satisfied, as was my mother. I saw many acts of kindness by my family and many others over the years, and I believe that generosity is part of the American way of life. However, I suspect that my mother would have been quite unhappy if a government agent had come along and confiscated her chili in order to share it with others who had nothing to eat. She would have felt that it was her chili, and that she had the right to share with whomever she wished. And therein lies one of the fundamental differences between capitalism and socialism. Socialism's underlying goal of sharing with others is noble. But amazingly, many Americans who are having financial difficulty would reject the idea of the government confiscating the assets of the wealthy to balance things out. This attitude bewilders many who believe in taxing the rich and redistributing that wealth as the solution to everything. Many of those seeking to gain political advantage in our system recognize that there are far more poor people than there are rich people, and that by stirring up class warfare, they can create an enormous power base for themselves. So far, this political strategy has failed to yield the promised fruit because most Americans value freedom above financial security. Just as centuries ago, the colonists rejected the protection promised by the British Crown, coupled with its ever-increasing taxes. As a testament to how socialism's safety net can begin to tear under the strain, in 2010, several financially distressed countries, Greece and Ireland as the prominent examples, experienced dramatic shortages of money, making it impossible for them to continue their overly generous social programs the general populace had come to expect. Massive protest and violent rioting broke out in the streets because people felt robbed of what they felt was their rightful share of the country's production. These countries had overextended themselves in terms of the benefits they had promised and simply could not take in enough revenue to fulfill their obligations. This, unfortunately, has happened in the past and will happen in the future because government-controlled programs continue to grow until they destroy themselves. The founding fathers of this nation were well aware of the perils associated with gigantic government programs, which is why they emphasized limited government and self-reliance. All you have to do is look at Greece and Ireland today to see the results of unrealistic promises made to the populace. We can already see some of the socialist bubbles being popped here in our own nation. In the not-too-distant past, public service jobs in the United States usually paid less than private sector jobs and didn't have as many benefits. It was indeed sacrificial public service. Today, federal civilian workers with no more than a high school education earned 20% more on average than similar workers in the private sector, and they have mind-boggling benefits, all at the taxpayer's expense. Furthermore, if you have ever tried to deal with a government bureaucracy, you probably know how difficult it is to find caring and competent people. For many people, a government job is a ticket to an easy life. The founders of our nation intended for government workers to be representatives and servants of their communities rather than beneficiaries. And they never intended for public servants to be economically better off than the general populace. Such overcompensation places an enormous strain on government budgets, necessitating increased tax rates. The desire to take care of everyone from cradle to grave is laudable. But I'm also pragmatic, and realize that one can only take care of everyone until there's no more money, at which time one can take care of no one. Or one can reduce the amount of financial aid and encourage people to live responsibly, to save, and to plan for the future. Obviously, the latter option makes more sense in the long run. For some reason, in recent decades, our national leaders have stopped looking so much at the long-term issues facing our country and have concentrated on short-term, stopgap measures that temporarily make them look good politically. The problem of caring for the indigent still remains, and as Jesus himself said, the poor you will always have with you. Some are poor due to mental or physical illness and or bad luck, and others are poor because they have no desire to work hard. There is a growing third group, however, those who work hard at lower middle-class, blue-collar jobs, but whose salaries are unable to keep up with the inflation of a reckless government fiscal policy over the past few decades, resulting in real wages failing to keep up with the cost of living for a family. Should we make a distinction between these groups when doling out social benefits? Believers in the capitalistic model are not likely to have a great deal of sympathy for those individuals who want to live off the labor of others, while believers in the socialistic model make provisions even for those individuals. I suspect, however, that if you took 100 people and placed them in a capitalistic society for several months, you would find most of them gainfully employed a year later. If you took that same 100 people and placed them in a socialistic society for several months, I suspect that a year later, you would find a large number of them on the dole. People tend to do what they need to do to survive and are unlikely to expend extra effort when it is unnecessary. This is the primary reason why traditionally socialistic societies are not highly productive. How then shall we live? There is no one-size-fits-all type of government. And much to the horror of some people, it is a fact that our own government is a blend of both capitalism and socialism. The issue, then, of how to handle able-bodied individuals who simply do not want to work in a society with mixed government, such as in the United States, remains very sticky. The issue can be demagogued endlessly by both sides without arriving at a solution. Approaching the issue logically, however, there are three practical solutions. 1. Tell those who don't work that they are on their own. 2. Take from those who have something and redistribute it to the individuals who aren't working. 3. Borrow from a third party in order to take care of the non-working individuals and leave the debt to future generations. Logically, with solution 1, the individual who isn't working clearly either starves or finds a job. What about solution 2? In this case, those who are forcibly constrained to support the individuals who aren't working eventually lose interest in working themselves, since the fruits of their labors are being confiscated. This, in turn, leads to even more individuals who aren't working. What about solution 3? The other party buys our treasury notes in great quantities, thereby acquiring ownership of a significant portion of our nation. But these investors are unlikely to extend credit indefinitely, nor will future generations continue to remain ignorant of this downward spiral forever. At some point, they will realize that their future is being compromised, and they will refuse to go along with the program. Thus, solution 1 is the only one that stands the test of logic and is the one upon which we should concentrate. Necessity is the mother of invention, and right now, it is necessary for us to create jobs while providing incentives to entrepreneurs and CEOs to keep coming up with new innovations and products. We must realize that excessive pay for executives is demoralizing to workers who don't feel that someone else in the same organization is worth well over 300 times more than they are. Fortunately, say-on-pay arrangements have entered corporate America recently, which allows shareholders to have a voice in compensation for top executives and makes boards of directors more careful in determining organizational compensation. Is it possible to implement solution 1 in a compassionate fashion? Of course it is, when compromise is introduced into the equation. Instead of immediately kicking individuals off the dole, they could be weaned off over a course of several months, giving them the opportunity to make necessary adjustments in their lives. Again, I should point out that we are only talking about able-bodied individuals who are capable of working but simply refuse to do so. I doubt that anyone in America would raise serious objections to taking care of individuals who simply are not capable of caring for themselves. Unemployment benefits certainly can be a stopgap measure for those truly seeking employment but temporarily out of work. They are, however, not a favor to many who are not truly seeking work, because the longer an unemployed individual is not working, the less employable he or she becomes. Such benefits should be linked to work that needs to be done in the community, such as Roosevelt's New Deal, in which government programs were created to provide jobs and stimulate growth in industry, transportation, banking, housing, agriculture, and many other areas. Who decides whose house it is? So what is the role of government when it comes to taking care of the poor? We can probably answer this question more easily if we leave off labels such as capitalism and socialism and instead focus on principles. Government is invested with power by the people who are governed because it is much easier and more orderly to have a central authority than for each person to serve as an authority unto himself. Natural law dictates that people have a right to protect their lives and their property, and this is a concept with which there is general societal agreement across all types of governmental systems throughout the history of the world. As an example, we live in a large country estate about 30 miles outside the city of Baltimore. Our kids are grown and have their own homes, and Candy and I are very content. We have no neighbors within shouting distance, and the drive from our front door to the public road is 3/4 of a mile. If someone who lived nearby presented himself on our doorstep and demanded that we trade houses with him because he has a large family with many children and they need the space. Whereas we have very few people and an extremely large house, I could refuse or I could voluntarily comply. If I refused and he became belligerent and attempted to forcibly evict us, I could attempt to protect my property, which could have some very unpleasant results, or I could call the police, which is an appropriate arm of our government whose duty includes the protection of my property and my life. This is exactly what the Founding Fathers envisioned as one of our governmental functions. If, on the other hand, our government officials decided my house was too big and the neighbor's house too small for his large family, and that they should confiscate my house and give it to my neighbor, or at the very least tax me at a high enough rate that they could redistribute my money to my neighbor who could then buy a bigger house, that kind of intrusive government would exemplify the very thing our Founding Fathers tried to avoid. Not only did Benjamin Franklin, Samuel Adams, and several of the other Founding Fathers speak out against government redistribution of property, but in 1795, the Supreme Court of the United States declared, "No man would become a member of a community in which he could not enjoy the fruits of his honest labor and industry." The preservation of property, then, is a primary object of the social compact. The legislature, therefore, had no authority to make an act divesting one citizen of his freehold and vesting it in another without a just compensation. It is inconsistent with the principles of reason, justice, and moral rectitude. It is incompatible with the comfort, peace, and happiness of mankind. It is contrary to the principles of social alliance and every free government. And lastly, it is contrary to the letter and spirit of the Constitution. In our attempt to be kind to the poor, we have deviated substantially from the principles involved in the founding of our nation. The United States is, in fact, historically and currently the most philanthropic nation in the history of the world. But our founders fully realized that prolonged government-sponsored charity would destroy the values of hard work, self-reliance, and compassion. I am involved with a number of charitable organizations that are dedicated to improving the lives of the many unfortunate people who live among us. One of those organizations is the Curtis D. Robinson Men's Health Institute at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center in Hartford, Connecticut. The driving force behind this organization, which screens hundreds of men without medical insurance for prostate cancer and offers free treatment when cancer is found, is my friend Curtis D. Robinson, who traveled from Alabama to Connecticut when he was 16 years old and penniless. He was very industrious, worked extremely hard, became CEO and owner of various businesses, and is now a multimillionaire. He has given away seven-figure amounts, receiving nothing in return except the satisfaction of knowing that lives that would have been lost are being saved. Many physicians, administrators, and caring citizens have joined Curtis in his efforts, as have I. It is very difficult to travel to any community in our nation and not find charitable organizations specifically created to aid the indigent citizens of that community. Our government used to fully understand the role of private sector charitable organizations in ameliorating the plight of the poor. This is why the government offered tax deductions and exemptions for churches and other charitable organizations. Today, the government actually competes with many of these private sector charities while still offering them tax deductions. How does this wasteful duplication benefit government or us, its citizens? Certainly, by creating huge government entitlement programs, the size and power of the government increases dramatically. Before long, people generally depend on government for everything, from food and shelter to health care and education to a comfortable retirement, instead of looking to government for the basic protection of life and property, as well as providing public roads and public safety. I believe Benjamin Franklin was one of the wisest men to ever walk the face of the earth. Was he a womanizer who enjoyed partying a bit too much? Probably. But he was a first-rate scholar, scientist, inventor, writer, and diplomat who was instrumental in the formation of our nation. He warned against inappropriate compassion, such as giving a drunk the wherewithal to buy liquor or smothering the human instinct to strive and excel by providing all basic necessities. I don't think you can say that he was selfish and simply wanted to preserve his wealth because the same Benjamin Franklin offered to pay the British from his own bank account for their losses during the Boston Tea Party in order to spare the colonists severe retribution by the king. Statements by Franklin and many of the other founders make it very clear that they were extremely opposed to the concept of wealth redistribution, which is a basic tenet of socialism. At an even more fundamental level, they were very much opposed to the concept of a large, intrusive central government, which they felt was really no different than the European monarchies they were trying to escape. Consider the United States' rapid acceleration to pinnacle status by means of a system rewarding hard work and vigorously protecting individual assets while encouraging compassion and charity. Why would we want to change unless there is historical proof that another system will work better? In a socialist society, the government has the right to tax whomever it wishes for whatever amount it deems necessary, whenever it wants. This leads to abusive, unchecked power that can eventually deprive many of the people of their rights, as our Declaration of Independence states, to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The insidious nature of socialism, cloaked in a facade of compassion, makes it very dangerous to an uneducated and trusting populace. And as socialism creates dependency, it is well on its way to eliminating freedom of choice and incentives for high productivity and innovation. Unions, strangling the goose that laid the golden egg. Stealth socialism has the ability to stay under the radar while co-opting legitimate entities such as unions, changing them into something that is barely recognizable. I have been a union member myself, and having grown up in Detroit, I am, of course, very familiar with the positive aspects of union representation. In the early days of the industrial age, the advent of unions brought about the kind of collective bargaining that resulted in fair wages and reasonable working conditions. Benefits derived through unions helped create the most prolific middle class the world has ever seen. Unfortunately, with time, many of the union bosses began to concern themselves with power and influence and used union dues, which had grown to become huge pots of money, to change the outcome of elections and to wreak havoc in many areas where money equaled power. By threatening strikes to further their causes, they were able to exact excessive wages and benefits from companies such as General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, in the long run, crippling these companies and rendering them non-competitive. The union leaders, their lawyers, accountants, and administrators were not dumb people, and they were well aware of the position they were putting these companies in. Essentially, they were strangling the goose that laid the golden egg. The blame for the recent downfall of Detroit's auto industry, however, does not rest solely on the shoulders of the union bosses. Top management in the auto industry negotiated deals that they knew were fiscally irresponsible and would be harmful to the company's future. They also knew that they would receive their golden parachutes, complete with multi-million-dollar severance packages for their irresponsibility, and be long gone when the day of reckoning arrived. One of the themes you may have begun to notice is that those entities that are bad for our nation tend to want what they want now, without thought to how it will affect future generations. If you use that principle as a measuring stick, in most cases you can easily determine which unions and other entities are good and which are deleterious to the prosperity of our nation. As this book is being written, massive protests are going on in the state of Wisconsin, where teachers' unions and state workers' unions are disgruntled about the governor's plan to bring the wildly out-of-control state budget back under control. One of the components of his plan involves having those workers make larger contributions to their own benefit packages rather than saddling taxpayers with that responsibility. Even with the increased amount of contribution, these workers will still be getting a much better and cheaper benefits package than their counterparts in the private sector. They realize this and are therefore capitulating to that requirement. However, they are not willing to relent on the issue of decreased collective bargaining rights. They feel that if they give on this point, the union will be weakened forever, and they will be at a significant disadvantage when negotiating future benefits and rights. They do not want to be at a disadvantage when it comes to issues such as class size, tenure, and evaluation of teacher competency. Of course, none of these come under the traditional banner of collective bargaining. The union leaders are focused solely on what they want and refuse to believe that the huge budget deficit is real. They believe the whole issue has been fabricated by the governor and his cronies in order to bring down the unions, but the accounting is fairly straightforward. Wisconsin is but one of many states in dire straits, facing enormous deficits in revenue. It is almost incomprehensible to me how selfish one must be to demand benefits today without consideration for what happens to our children tomorrow. Nevertheless, I do not see those who disagree with me as enemies, and I am happy to engage them in conversations about our future and how to ensure success for our children. Capitalism versus socialism. Can we incorporate the best of both worlds? The security provided by socialistic governments can be addicting to the point that citizens are willing to give up many of their individual rights. Although you have the right to accumulate wealth, there is not much incentive to do so if it can be confiscated by the government at will. Although you have the right to work many years beyond the traditional age of retirement, many who are addicted to the socialist system retire as early as possible. In some European countries, citizens often take advantage of this while they are in their 50s and early 60s. As a result, those societies lose some of their most experienced and effective workers and potential mentors who do not want to miss out on overly generous retirement benefits guaranteed to them by a bloated government. When government interferes too much in the private lives of its citizens, the losses can become widespread. In the previous chapter, we examined the enormous benefits to our country and to the world of an economic system, capitalism, that encourages innovation, hard work, and entrepreneurship. Now, after examining the pros and cons of socialism, we have seen mostly negative effects, even in terms of its lauded compassionate components, which seem good at first glance, but reveal disincentives to work and fiscal irresponsibility in the long run. Because we live in a free and open society, those who advocate socialism are free to do so. But in my opinion, it is easy for any well-read individuals to discern for themselves the agenda of the socialist and how they are implementing that agenda in an attempt to bring fundamental change to America. The agenda? Total government control. For jobs, income, you name it. As the responsibilities for total care of the individuals in a society are turned over to the government, the control of those individuals' lives is also turned over to the government. Certainly, there are degrees of socialism or government control, and there are individuals in every society who wish to control others. The real question for Americans, who are freedom-loving people, is are we willing to sacrifice our independence for a sense of security that we could otherwise guarantee through hard work and personal responsibility? The whole thing seems more like a game, and those who do not know history and are not vigilant will be on the losing side. Hopefully, the people of America will continue to love freedom and claim responsibility for their own lives and for the future of their children. Socialists have long dreamed of providing cradle-to-grave security as long as they have control of everything. Certainly, security is good, but the risk of giving up sovereignty over one's own life outweigh the benefits. We can still extract some positive aspects of the system, however. For example, providing basic health care for every citizen can be done quite easily without increasing our national debt one penny. If we address our inefficient and wasteful billing and collections procedures, move to a national electronic medical record, provide people with incentives to use clinics instead of emergency rooms for primary care, and engage in meaningful tort reform to limit costly lawsuits, we would have plenty of money to provide basic health care to all citizens of this country. We could also realize significant revenue by combating fraud in government entitlements such as Medicare and Medicaid. And in our free society, individuals wanting to purchase additional health care insurance can certainly do so without negatively impacting anyone else. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and our food stamp program, among others, are all socialist-leaning programs that help provide our nation with a social safety net. Their growth, however, must be controlled, and self-sufficiency must be the goal of our society. The masses should not depend solely upon these social programs. Instead, they should be encouraged early in life to make provisions for themselves and their families well into the future. If we steadfastly resist the excessive growth of government and its ever-increasing appetite for tax money, reminding our government that there is a document known as the Constitution of the United States that defines and limits its role in our lives, then we will have an opportunity to learn from past mistakes and build on successes to create the kind of nation that will continue to work for all of us. Chapter 7. What is a moral nation? I've always been a compassionate person, sometimes to a fault. After finishing high school and while pursuing my goal of becoming a physician, I befriended a young man whose personal troubles were interfering with his studies, putting him in grave danger of flunking out if he failed to pass the final comprehensive exam. Since his mind was so confused with all that was going on in his life at the time, he had been incapable of retaining material and had no chance of passing. Knowing me to be a very honest person with a deep relationship with God and a strong moral code of ethics, he was terrified to ask me what he felt was his only remaining choice. He wanted me to allow him to copy my answers. This presented me with a great moral dilemma, because he was a good person who was normally quite capable of passing the exam. I knew that once he got through his personal problems, he would be fine. I tried hard to justify my involvement in cheating, and in the end, I did indeed allow him to look at my answers, even though I knew it was wrong. He passed the exam with my help and went on to become a very successful professional who has made a positive difference in the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. In this case, did the end justify the means? He had already gone to the administration requesting a leave of absence and was told that his only option was to pass the exam. Nevertheless, if he had exerted enough effort, I feel confident that another solution could have been found. I regret cheating, but I am profoundly happy for his success today. Not long after that, when I was a psychology major delving into the mysteries of the human mind, I stepped unknowingly into yet another moral dilemma. During my research for one of the papers in an advanced psychology course, I found some passages that seemed particularly appropriate, and I included them in my writing. I did not, however, indicate that this was the work of someone else. Frankly, I had never even heard of the term plagiarism. When the professor asked me to make an appointment to discuss my paper, I was befuddled. When I stepped into his office, however, I could immediately sense the weight of the moment. He pointed out that I had plagiarized and told me that the consequences for doing so normally included expulsion. I could see all of my dreams of becoming a doctor dashed by my stupidity. Even though I did not know the implications of plagiarism, I certainly should have known inherently that what I was doing was wrong. I had done it before without consequences and probably would have continued doing it if I had not been caught. Fortunately for me, the professor was very compassionate, realized that I was naive, and gave me a chance to rewrite the paper. This raises another question. Is ignorance an acceptable excuse for unethical behavior? Certainly those who sanctioned slavery in America thought that black people were inferior and that they were actually doing them a favor by liberating them from the jungles of Africa to associate with superior beings. How easy it is to suppress morality for the sake of expediency. They tried every form of rationalization to justify something that they knew was immoral and totally opposed to the self-evident truths that were part of the founding of this nation, namely, that all men are created equal. But even that phrase raises questions about equality and how we treat our fellow man. When I was a medical student in Michigan, many of our clinical rotations took place at the county hospital, and a large number of the patients served at this facility were indigent and had no means of paying the hospital bills. Those patients were assigned to the service controlled by the chief resident, not yet an attending physician, while the patients with insurance were assigned to one of the attending physicians with more experience. The chief resident could consult with any attending physician about cases on his service, but he would be the primary caregiver. This meant that there was a double standard of care quality based on a patient's ability to pay. This practice was common throughout the nation at that time, but has now been largely abandoned. One could legitimately argue that charity cases should be grateful for whatever they can get and that there is nothing immoral about differentiating the care that people receive based on status. As a society, we make life and death decisions all the time based on status. When a disaster occurs, we evacuate children and women first. If a boat is sinking, the life jackets go to the most vulnerable passengers. This greatly complicates the task of deciding what is or is not moral. In the case of the patients at the county hospital, they all received excellent care, and the majority of them did not even realize that their primary caregiver was a resident rather than an attending physician. Also, it is imperative that resident physicians assume significant responsibility in patient care before they become attending physicians. Every great attending physician was once a resident in need of experience that could only be gained by managing a patient's agenda directly. Having said that, I have no doubt that many would argue vociferously that it is immoral to have such distinctions in patient care. they would say that patients should be randomly assigned to caretakers, including residents, which would give resident physicians the necessary experience to one day assume the role of attending physician. A few years ago, I was consulted by a woman who was 33 weeks pregnant with a baby who had been diagnosed by ultrasound to have hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. She was on her way to Kansas at the recommendation of her local obstetrician to have an abortion. As Kansas was the only state that would allow a baby to be aborted that was perfectly viable outside the womb without life support. I discussed with her in great detail the implications of having a baby with hydrocephalus, and I discussed with her the many options that were available. In the end, she decided to complete the pregnancy, and we were able to place a shunt in the baby after it was born to divert excess fluid away from the brain. Although the baby had some developmental delays, she continues to thrive today. Some years ago, I was discussing this case with the head of the ACLU, who had made a statement that the purpose of their organization was to speak for and defend those who could not speak for and defend themselves. I asked whether or not this 33-week-old fetus qualified as a human being incapable of speaking for or defending itself. He artfully dodged answering the question, so I decided to make it easier for him. I told him that there were many premature infants in our neonatal intensive care unit who were several weeks younger than the baby in question. These babies were on life support, but in most cases, we had every expectation that they would survive. I asked him if he would speak for and defend the rights of a 28-week-old baby who was in an incubator and on life support. He replied that that was a no-brainer. Of course, the ACLU would defend such an individual. As you might imagine, I then asked why it was difficult to defend a baby that was 5 weeks further along in development and was in the most protected environment possible, but easy to defend a less viable individual who was outside of the womb. He realized his answers were not logical, he said, but he felt that ultimately a woman had the right to terminate a pregnancy until the second that child is born. This situation perhaps crystallizes one of the major moral dilemmas we face in American society today. Does a woman have the right to terminate another human life because it is encased in her body? Does ownership convey absolute power of life and death over the own subject? If it does, then NFL quarterback Michael Vick was unfairly imprisoned for torturing and killing dogs in Virginia. Still paying for our sordid moral past.